Okay, so mobile IP is right here. Okay, so this is basically what happens in mobile IP. So essentially, there is something called a home location, okay, that is retained. Okay, so if I get a mobile IP address for my machine and machine has a home location in CS, it will get an IP address in the CS domain. But this machine can go anywhere. So whenever some other machine tries to contact it, it actually sends all of its packet to the home location. The home location is the one that keeps track of where this machine is at any given point in time, and it transparently sends off, creates a tunnel that forwards all the packet. In this case, the client home is here on the East Coast and the machine is somewhere in Asia at this point. Okay? So this home location actually keeps track of the current location and then it forwards all packets to that machine. So this is how you can actually have mobile entities in your distributed system. So in addition to now an IP address, you also have to keep track of the current location. Again, forward packets to that location. Now if you think about it, this is actually widely prevalent in other systems. So in the cell phone system, for example, this is automatically being done. Okay? You can take your cell phone, you can roam anywhere. The system is keeping track of where your phone is so you can keep receiving phone calls or make phone calls. Okay, that's the same thing that is being done there. Whenever your phone enters any new cell tower, recognizes it, it actually updates an entry somewhere saying the phone is currently here. Okay? So if somebody tries to call you, you actually look up that in database first, which is called a location registry, saying where is this cell phone, and then he says, okay, it's now in this region. And there's a cell phone tower there, so all packets are routed there. And your cell phone can move, and you can talk while you're moving. And you can change, go from one cell tower to another. All of this is handled transparently. Okay, same is true here. Okay, while you're forwarding packets, you can actually move with your laptop. You can drive around and so on. You can change location, then the location will keep getting updated here, and packets will get sent to you. So this is one additional thing that you have to keep in mind in naming system. If the entity that you are trying to look up is itself mobile, then you have one more dimension, which is the location, that also has to be kept in your the naming system. Okay, and then you have to use that to track down that object. Any questions at all here? Yeah. Before I switch gears. No. Okay. So, I can explain the steps. So, this is just steps of mobile IP. Okay, so what happens is, you have a host here that is trying to contact your laptop. Okay, your laptop has a home on this in this location here. But the actual machine is there. Okay, that's the actual location. So, when this machine tries to contact your machine, it sends packets to your home location first. Okay, what your home location will do is it will actually, it has kept track of where your actual location is, so it will just forward that packet there. Okay, so until this client knows you are there, it will just keep sending packets here, and this will just keep forwarding packet there. But at some point, this client can then send an update saying, I am actually at that location, so just send packet directly there. So now it will return the address of the current location. That can be returned here. So subsequently, if your location hasn't changed, you can just send packet directly from this machine there. Okay. Initially it is forwarded and then it is sent directly. So this is the same thing that happens when you have postal mail. Right? If you move, let's say, an apartment, you keep a forwarding address. So the post office actually forwards mail, and then subsequently you may notify the sender saying, I moved to this address. So mail can come to you directly. Same thing is happening here.
You mean the initial packet should be sent from the home location?
Yes. Initially all packets are sent here, and this is just forwarding to the client. So no matter which way you go, you are receiving packets, whether it's coming indirectly through the home location or directly. But initially this client doesn't know where you are, so it will send packets to your home location. That's how mobile IP works. Any other questions here? Yes. How LDAP helps in password authentication? So one of the entries in LDAP is your username. You can have your password in there. It's encrypted. It's like slash, just as you store in slash etc slash password, username and password, this all of this information is held in LDAP as well.
Okay.
Right.
So, but that's on Unix.
Correct. So
it also could be using the same. So we have some common database.
So some information is stored locally, and only the password is stored in the database. Okay, so you're just saying, is this the right password for this user? And then you just get an answer yes or no. What you do once you're authenticated is a different issue. Right, so this is just simple password lookup. That's all. Okay, so now we are going to switch gears and move on to the next chapter. Okay, but just before I do that, I just want to point out that we have covered what? About 200 pages of the book. There's this much. Okay, so we have this much more to go. But the point I'm trying to make is we are actually making good progress, and you need to keep up. Okay, keep reading. Otherwise, you will be at the midterm and you'll have to review like half the book in 3 days, and that doesn't work. Okay, so keep up with the class, because I mean, I just did a whole chapter in a class. Okay, so there is a lot more details in the book. So it's your job to keep up with the class and do your background reading, and if you have questions, come and ask me. Okay, so now we are actually going to come to an important topic in this course, which is canonical problems in distributed systems. This is chapter 6, incidentally. And what we will do in this chapter is look at several problems that arise in design of distributed systems and distributed applications, but we'll look at them in abstract instead of saying how is this particular issue addressed in DNS or how is this done in the World Wide Web. We'll just say, okay, here are some problems that occur again and again, and we'll look at clock synchronization, leader election, distributed mutual exclusion, distributed transactions, and a whole bunch of others, and say what are some approaches to address these problems. And then once you know this, then you have to, if you are designing an actual system and you need synchronization, then you look at this and say, there are 3 techniques we looked at in this topic. Here is the best synchronization algorithm for this particular application. Okay. But since these problems occur repeatedly in a variety of different settings, we are going to actually abstract them out and look at them as individual problems without the specific application setting. Okay. So today we are going to look at just the first one. This is going to be several lectures worth of material. We are going to start here. Okay, and then we'll keep going down the list. We'll look at one at a time. Okay, so let's start with clock synchronization. Okay, so what is the problem of clock synchronization? Why is it interesting? Is the first thing to understand. Okay. So again, clock synchronization is less of an issue if your application is completely centralized, runs on one machine. Okay? And the reason for this is that on a single machine, every machine in this case, a computer, has a system clock. Okay? This tells you what the clock time on that machine is. Okay? So if you have only one application, if it needs to use time for any reason, it is just going to look up the system clock and say this is the current time, and you are done. But if you have a distributed application, the assumption is these components run on different machines. Okay? If they need to use timing for any reason whatsoever, to do any reasoning, okay, now you have to have clocks on these two machines synchronized with one another. Otherwise, if the clocks are drifting, one machine says it's noon, the other one says no, it's 1 o'clock, and you're actually relying on this time to do some computation, but the clocks are all off, then you're going to get erroneous results. And so what this says is somehow we need techniques to synchronize clocks across machines, and that is what this topic is about. Okay, so we will have I'll talk about examples where you get erroneous results, and then we'll see how one goes about doing this. Okay, before that, I just want to mention that this clock I mentioned on all machines, they're basically crystal based clocks. Okay, there's an oscillator that is there on the machine that basically allows you to keep time. Okay. Whenever this oscillator, it has a frequency, it basically vibrates or whatever, oscillates for some number of times, you tick a clock saying it's 1 second has gone by, and then you keep time in this fashion. Okay. Now, here is an example of what can go wrong if you have a system that is distributed and you're trying to do something. So in this case, what you're doing is you're just editing a file and running make. Okay. Make basically allows you to only compile parts of your application that whose source code has changed. So if your application has 10 source files and you only modify one file and you do make, it's not going to recompile the other 9 files because they have not changed. You already have the object code for this file, you only recompile this one file. Now the way it works is it actually, the way it figures out what files have changed is by looking at the timestamps on the files. So it looks at, so here is basically output.c, this is the C code, and this is output.o that was compiled from output.c. So if you change the file, okay, in the normal case, suppose that you compiled it and it has the, this file has this timestamp, okay, and then subsequently you modified the file and saved it. So the assumption is that this file now has a timestamp that's greater. The modification time on this file has to be greater than this because this really happened later. So in this case, make compare saying what is the timestamp on this source file, what is the timestamp on the object file. Source file is newer than the object file, so it must have changed, so it will recompile it. Okay. So it's using timing to figure out which files are. Now if you are doing the editing and compilation on the same machine, this is going to work out because you compiled it sometime back, it has an older timestamp, and subsequently modified it in editor and saved it. And the clock has ticked in the meantime, so this has a newer timestamp than that file. Everything is fine. Okay? Now what will happen or what can go wrong if you have a file that you are editing on one machine but compiling on another? Suppose you are editing on your local desktop. Okay, it's a network file, meaning it's actually resides on some other file server. So when you save it, it goes back to the file server, and for whatever reason, let's say the file server is a faster machine, so you are running make there, not on your local machine. So in this case, what can happen is if the clocks on these two things are not synchronized, you are going to be in trouble. In particular, if your machine has a clock that is lagging the clock on the machine on which you are compiling. Okay, you compiled some time back, you got a timestamp. Your clock, let's say, is 1 hour behind the clock on that. So you subsequently you edited it and you saved it. But when you saved it, you gave it a timestamp that is still less than this one, although that event actually happened after that. Okay. So make is now not able to detect the ordering of events. The ordering of events here is the compilation of this file was before the editing of the file. So the file is newer, you need to recompile. But because the clock is lagging, if you just compare timestamps, you infer something incorrect. Okay? So you are not going to, in other words, make is not going to compile this file for you and your application is just going to have weird bugs. Okay, because you made some modification, it didn't get compiled. So this is just one example that says you need to have synchronized clock across machine. There are lots of other problems that can occur. Okay, so with that motivation, let's start talking about synchronization. But here's a quick primer on clock and time. Okay, you need to understand the concept of time and what clocks do. Okay, so typically in the olden days, you used you kept time using astronomy. Right, basically, what noon was basically the time when the sun was right above your head. Right, so that's what was defined to be noon, and then you assume that a day is 24 hours long, and so on. So that's how you kept time. Now, in the modern world, you use atomic clocks to keep time. You no longer use solar time because even that is inaccurate. So what you do is you basically use atoms and oscillations of electrons within the atoms to keep track of time. This is supposed to be very accurate. In other words, these clocks can lose a second of time in thousands or tens of thousands of years. So they're very accurate clocks. And that is what you use to actually say what is the current time. Okay, so these are also called atomic clocks. And for each time zone or some number of time zones, there will be atomic clock. So and then there is the notion of time zones also. The time is not the same everywhere, right? So there's what is called coordinated universal time. This used to be called GMT or Greenwich Mean Time. Okay? So that's the reference time for everyone else on the earth. Okay? So you basically have time zones and you may be X hours off from universal time. So you can start with universal time, see what's the time there, and then depending on your time zone, you add or subtract some number of hours. Okay? That tells you your local time. Okay? Now the way typically computers actually get hold of these clocks. So if you want to synchronize somehow, you have to figure out there has to be some reference somewhere, some atomic clock that you synchronize to. Okay. Now the way this is done in the US is there's a radio channel that is just broadcasting a time. Okay. And you are basically using the atomic clock and just use it. So there's an atomic clock in Colorado. Okay. So there's a shortwave station that just broadcasts the time that atomic clock is. So you can, if you have a shortwave receiver, you can just sync or sort of listen on that channel and just pick up the time and then synchronize the local clock with that time. There are many other sources of broadcast signals as well. There are some satellite broadcasts. If you use the GPS system, okay, in this case the satellites are broadcasting time that they get from an atomic clock. Okay, or if you use the cell phone system, cell towers are also broadcasting time. Okay, this allows your cell phone to actually pick up the current. So there are many sources that are actually broadcasting this atomic clock. Okay, but there is one source somewhere that they are using to broadcast. And you have to listen on any one of these sources and then synchronize your machine. Okay, so that's how we'll go about synchronizing. Okay, now let's look at some basics of how clock synchronization works. Okay, so here is a picture that shows the basic concept. So this is universal time. Okay, this is basically a time, the real time, and this is some clock somewhere, okay, which is going to be off from the universal. This is the y-axis. If your clock was perfect, in other words, if this clock was never drifted, you would basically get a curve that says the slope of this curve will be 1. Every time this clock ticks 1 second, that clock is also going to tick 1 second. So these will be perfectly aligned, you will get a slope of 1. Okay. If this clock is slower, you will basically tick slower than that time. So your clock is going to advance along this curve, which is slower than universal time. So the slope of this curve is going to be less than 1. If your clock is faster, it will go faster. So if this takes 1, you will basically take 1 plus epsilon. Right? So you will be faster and your slope of that curve is going to be greater than 1. Okay. Now, the real problem here is you have two clocks, let's assume, and you want to synchronize them with one another. One way to synchronize it is have each of these clocks synchronized directly with an atomic clock, in which case they are automatically synchronized. Okay, but typically not every clock has the capability to go and synchronize with an atomic clock. So what we will do is we'll figure out when should these two clocks synchronize with one another, assuming that one of them is synchronized to an atomic clock. Okay, that's the assumption. So here we have, so basically what this is saying is we define the notion of a clock drift, which is the amount by which this clock is drifting from real time. Okay, there's a maximum drift rate rho for any physical clock, because any physical clock is going to have some inaccuracy. So typically if you have maximum drift rate rho, then you will be either 1 minus rho, or your clock value is going to be either 1 minus, or rate at which your clock is advancing is going to be between these two bounds, 1 minus rho and 1 plus rho, which is basically in these two regimes. Okay, so you'll be somewhere in between. This is the fastest clock that you have, and this is the slowest clock. You define it somehow, and you will be somewhere in there. Okay. So also what this means is any two physical clocks are going to drift by a maximum of 2 rho every delta t time units. Okay. Because in the worst case, one of those clock will be slow, another one will be fast. So they will drift faster from one another. And will be in particular, they will drift 2 rho time units every delta t time units. Okay. So if you want to limit the drift between these two clocks to less than delta, this is the accuracy that you demand on your synchronization. So if you say, I don't want these two clocks to drift, be off by more than 1 second. Suppose you impose this restriction. Okay. And if their drift rate is rho, that says that they need to resynchronize with one another every delta or 2 rho seconds. Okay, to limit the drift to no more than delta. Okay, this is the time, maximum time by which the two clocks can be off from one another. Okay, so this is basically telling you how frequently does the clock synchronization algorithm have to run and resynchronize this clock. Okay, so given a certain drift rate, rho, and given the maximum drift and some tolerance on the amount of drift, you will figure out the frequency of resynchronization, okay, which is delta over 2 rho. Any questions on this? Is this clear? Okay. So now we'll talk about the first one. Now this is telling us how frequently to resynchronize, but it doesn't tell you how to resynchronize. Okay? And that those are the clock synchronization algorithms we will study. Okay, the first one is called Christian's algorithm. Okay, so what this does is that it is assumed that there is some time server somewhere on your network, and that machine is somehow synchronized to some authoritative source. So maybe that machine has a receiver for an atomic clock signal and is resynchronizing itself. So we'll assume the time server has accurate time. So all other machines on your network now it's synchronized with the time server. And since the time server itself is synchronized with an atomic clock, all machines also have correct time. That's the assumption. Yeah, so here we have the time server, and here we have a machine that wants to synchronize with the time server. Okay. So every delta over two row time units, we will basically run this clock synchronization algorithm, and all it is going to do is it will send a request over a network to the time server saying, what's your time? Okay. Time server is going to say, this is my current time. You get back this response, and so now you know the time on the time server, and you resynchronize with this time. Okay. Now everything would be fine if the latency of this request over the network was zero. Okay. But typically there is going to be some network latency to send the request to the time server and to get back the response. Okay. This is, so the forward direction, the latency is T request. The reverse direction, the request is T reply. So you have to compensate for this delay. Okay. Otherwise you are going to be off, because the time that the clock servers, the time server sent was this time. But by the time this packet actually arrived here, your T reply time units are already gone by. So if you just use that time and set this one, you will be off by this much. Okay, so you have to compensate for this network latency, and that is what this clock synchronization does. So basically it receives time from the time server, and you need to now figure out what's the round trip delay. Okay? So the simplest thing is you will take T request plus T reply over 2 as an estimate of the one way delay. Okay? So you basically need to now set the time as T plus T reply. Okay? But you don't really know what T reply is, but you do know this time, because you know when you send the request, you know when you got the reply. So if you make an approximation here saying this time and this time are identical, but they are not. Okay, this is just a simplification. You will just use that as your estimate. Okay, so you'll use T request as T reply over 2 as an estimate of T reply, and then you'll just set your time to T plus T reply. Okay, now you set your time to the same as the time server. This is what this time synchronization algorithm does. Okay, at this very basic level. Now the only interesting thing here is to how to make this estimate. Okay. Because we already assume time server knows accurate time, so that's not a problem. You can ask for the time, get back a reply and set your time. Again, that's not a problem. The only thing is how accurately can you compensate for this. Okay, that determines the accuracy of your clock synchronization algorithm itself. Okay. So over a sequence of measurements, you can come up with better and better estimates of T reply. Okay, T reply can actually change depending on network conditions, as you can imagine. Because this is a network. If the network is congested, you may have more latency than if it is not. Okay? But you have to make a sequence of measurements and come up with better estimate, and then you will be able to synchronize yourself. Okay? So this is the first and most basic clock synchronization algorithm. Because we have run out of time, we will talk about the other ones next time, but this is sort of where we will pick up. Okay? So don't go yet, because I have homeworks here. I'm going to just...